This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. There are certain things that we are told over and over about high technology, to the point where it seems that we accept them now without question. The idea that the pace of change, of high-tech change, is getting faster and faster. That the internet and the personal computer have revolutionized everything. That these kinds of developments in technology always increase productivity. That is, we accomplish more and we do it more efficiently. And that whatever is new is the best. Well, our guest for this part of Focus 580, Bob Seidensticker, someone who's got a lot of years of experience in the computer industry, says that it's probably not true. Probably not any of it is true, at least not to the extent that we'd like to believe it. And he's authored a book that makes some of these arguments. The book is titled Future Hype: The Myths of Technology Change. The book is out now in paperback if you're interested in reading it, and we'll explore some of the ideas in the book in this part of the show, and invite people to call in and ask questions, of course. Our guest had his first experience in computer programming when he was in high school in the mid-1970s. He then went to MIT, worked on designing digital hardware, and worked for a number of IT companies, 8 years at Microsoft. He left there in 1997. He was program manager on a number of projects there, including Windows 3.0 and the first ROM-based version of Windows. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome, as always. All you have to do to participate in the program is to pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Now, that's good to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, whichever works best for you, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, do the first one, 333-9455. But if you're outside of the immediate area here, if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And again, whenever you have questions, comments, you want to join in, you can give us a call. Mr. Seidensticker, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Do you think that it has always been the case that when some new technology has come along, I mean, as far as we know, when some new technology has come along, it has been generally speaking, embraced with great enthusiasm, and people did the same kind of gee whiz things that we do now where they say, gee, this is the greatest thing ever, and isn't this going to change everything?
You're right. It's a little bit of the same old with the latest technology. Right now, it's the computer and the internet which have all the buzz. It's all the excitement. That's where things are changing. And yet in the past, we've had aerospace, railroads, telegraph, telephone, electricity, energy, lots of things in the past which were, I would think, equally powerful in terms of the impact they had on society.
Now, it seems to me, though, I think that you're right if you point to it that period in the 19th century where there seemed to be so much technological change and a lot of things happened very quickly. I'm sure that for people at the time that also felt a little mind-boggling and unsettling. Having said that, though, it seems that the pace of change since World War II has been really significant. But it sounds as if you're arguing that, well, yes, there has been a lot of change, but that you can look at other periods where there has been equivalent kind of change. So it's not exactly like maybe there are plateaus, but it's not exactly like this has never happened before.
I think that if you look back at history and look at all the examples and don't forget them, you'll see that the pace of change, at least since the Industrial Revolution about 200 years ago, has been about the same. And actually, to address your points about, you know, today versus prior technologies, it is true that the PC and the internet are unprecedented, and yet that's been true for every major technology that we've had, certainly since the Industrial Revolution. So we need to avoid inflating the benefit, the impact of today's technology, and minimizing that in the past. If we make that mistake, we're going to imagine an exponentially increasing curve, and we'll say, well, if you think today's change is amazing, you know, you haven't seen anything yet, wait for 10 years, it'll really be crazy. Or said another way, if you're having a hard time keeping up now, you'll really be flailing in 10 years, and it's just not the case. It doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. So you think that that kind of, for example, when you look at these projections about speed and capacity of personal computers, getting more and more power into a smaller box, the idea is that that's something that just keeps going on and on and on. You would say, no, eventually we're, maybe physics just will come into play at some point. Reality comes into play at some point and says, no, there is a certain point that you just don't, you can't, as far as we know, that you can't go past.
I think you have two factors there. One is the point you raise, which is that Moore's law, this observation that computing power roughly doubles every couple of years, will eventually end. But I think perhaps the more important point is, even with the amazing impact that Moore's law has had on computers, to some extent, you have to ask the question, so what? If I were to replace the computer you have with one that was 100 times faster, it wouldn't make you 100 times more productive. Hmm. It wouldn't make you twice as productive. And yet, if you look at something as mundane as a truck, it has a certain capacity. It's carrying dirt or lumber or whatever. And if you double the capacity of the truck, you double the productivity of the operator. It's really simple. And that's the way construction equipment works, factory machines, farming equipment. And yet, somehow, in the case of the PC, the lower-level improvements in speed don't percolate up to something meaningful in the user level, like making us more productive.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it's not that you can't say that it hasn't changed things at all.
And
you, you can't say that it is true that these devices enable us to do things that we couldn't do before, and maybe do some of the same things that we did before, but do them better, perhaps. But at the same time, you seem to be suggesting that, and perhaps this is something that's happened because people want to sell us stuff, that we've really been sold a bill of goods about the benefits of this technology.
Exactly right. And there's certainly examples like you go for a vacation in France, and you bring out your Visa card or MasterCard, and you pay for something. And, you know, when you sort of think about, okay, this little shop here is communicating back to my bank, wherever it is, and making sure they have the right balance and doing all that kind of stuff, and it happens in, 30 seconds. That's pretty impressive, and computers allowed that to happen. So, of course, there have been some powerful changes. What we need to watch out for is number one, thinking that those changes are bigger than they actually are, and number two, remembering how much we pay for those things. And the cost behind some of these things is kind of surprising.
Yeah. Well, can you flesh that out a little bit?
Sure, exactly. And let me just give you sort of a personal example, a individual example. Say you buy a laptop. You think you're buying a computer, but you're really buying computerization. So say that laptop costs $1,000 and you upgrade every 2 years. That's $500 per year. So far, not a big deal. And yet studies show that the total cost is more like $5,000 per year. The reason is because of these hidden costs, things like maintenance, software upgrades, training time, downtime. And, of course, the big one is when users like you and I have to figure out computer problems ourselves. This thing worked yesterday, and it's not working today. What the heck is the problem? I got to figure this out. It's if we imagine our own time has no value, then that's not a big deal, but that's, of course, nonsense. Mm-hmm. And then if we look at computers IT on the big scale worldwide, business spends on information technology $2.7 trillion per year. Now, what that says to me is that if business worldwide got a benefit every year of $2.7 trillion, they would just break even. So the cost of all this is phenomenal. It's uncountably huge. So it's the challenge we have is that it's easy to point out some of these amazing, cool new things that we only have thanks to the internet and the PC and so on. But we need to remember how much this cost. Finding the benefits is a little bit more challenging than finding the cost sometimes.
Yeah, well, certainly I think about the just how much time people end up, as you say, how much time people end up investing in some new device that they have gotten as they learn, try to figure out how to use it. And maybe my life is just not complicated enough, but the idea of something like a BlackBerry, a PDA, I just think... For me, a paper desk calendar works just fine. Now, as I say, you know, maybe I just haven't got enough going on in my life, but it seems to me that it takes an awful lot of energy sometimes to make those things work, and I don't know how well we consider the trade-off between the new technology and an older technology that will do the same thing, and how much time it really takes to make the new thing, to get the new thing integrated into our lives.
Quite true, yeah. When I think about in my own life, as you mentioned, I've been doing computer things since the 70s, and just to imagine myself going back to computer 101, if I knew nothing about computers, how long would it take me to recreate the knowledge that I have to deal with computers? It's almost like, you know, learning French. I mean, it's a huge amount of effort, and I think that so many users, already having gone through that, they sort of say, oh yeah, well, it was kind of a hassle, but I don't really think about it very much, and they sort of dismiss the challenge for a new user. So if a new coworker is coming on board and the new person is new to computers, you say, oh, you know, it's not a big deal, you know, you just do this, just do that, ignoring how hard that is, mm-hmm. to go from square one to being a competent computer user is truly a challenge. And again, we so often dismiss that.
Well, I also think, though, go back to the time when the idea of the computer was new-ish, and the people talked about the future of computer revolution, and where people talked about how everybody was going to have to learn how to program. And, of course, no, it's not true. Everybody doesn't need to know how to program, and that you don't really need to know how the machine works in order to make it work, to do the thing you want to do. Now, that doesn't mean it's always easy to get it to do what you want it to do. But one wonders whether, in fact, you could at least expect some increases in user friendliness with some of these devices in the future, or do you say, well, it's always kind of going to be like, it's always going to be a pain from time to time as you're trying to get it to do what you want it to do?
Yeah, going back to the point of having to learn how to program and what our attitude toward computers has changed. In the 1840s, 50s, 60s, you can imagine people in public schools saying, hey, the telegraph is so vitally important to our future, which of course it was. We need to teach everybody how to do Morse code. And I think it's an analogous kind of thing where in the late 70s, early 80s, we said, oh, this computer is just amazing. We need to teach everybody how to program. And you're right that we have had a layer of user interface and software that shields us, shields the users from having to worry about this kind of thing. That actually illustrates the challenge that computers have had in schools, which is, I think, a real test bed, a real experiment in how computers can be used to help people. So in the early 80s, as you mentioned, what's a computer good for? It's good to learn how to program, and that's what they were used for. And then we taught kids how to use Logo. It was a learning environment for computers. And then it was something else. And it seemed every couple of years, it was, oh, what were we thinking? We were just out of it. But now we've got it. Now we really understand. And now we have to have lots more computers, lots more software, lots more training for teachers. And it really illustrates to me the folly sometimes of just sort of grabbing onto technology which is not quite ready for prime time and saying, this is going to be so cool, it's going to make so much difference, let's just kind of throw it out there and see what happens. Again, ignoring the expense.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Bob Seidensticker, he's the author of the book Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. Barrett Kaler Publishers, and so it's out in paperback. If you want to look for it in the bookstore, I'm sure you can find it. Questions are welcome too, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have somebody up in the north. Western part of the state, Sycamore, on our toll-free line here, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to address one of the amusing things that I found about computers as I've been using them since they became available. My goodness, probably 20 years now. And when I started off, I think the first machine I used had maybe a 10 megahertz clock, and you know, the programs ran on it reasonably well. Some things I needed to do were a little slow, but, you know, it chugged along and did its thing. And as the technology progressed and clock speeds increased, it just seemed like we were never getting anywhere. And now, you know, you'd think with these 2 gigahertz machines, that the answers ought to be present on the screen the moment you press the key. And it's not. They still seem to take a rather pokey amount of time getting the results there. And it's like, wait a minute. Why aren't we progressing here? We need to have a machine. You know, my ideal computer would be as soon as you press the last key to give it the final instruction, blink, the answer's there. Now, that might take, a quarter of a second or a tenth of a second or something, but it would be very, very brief. I'd just be curious about your comments.
That's a great point. In fact, if you think about the Internet, which is the latest incarnation, imagine clicking on something and saying, okay, I'm going to hold my breath until this is done, and maybe you'll have a one-second time, or maybe you'll have 30 seconds. I mean, it's to some extent gone backwards. So the point you raise about the computer is sort of exacerbated when you have the Internet and all its difficult, all the things that have to happen before the response comes back. There's something actually called, colloquially, Andy and Bill's Law, sort of a response to Moore's Law. And the way the law goes is, what Andy Grove giveth, Bill Gates taketh away. That is, as speed increases, the software uses up that speed, and we, the user, saying, what happened here? And I think that, to a large extent, that's what you're seeing. There are some applications which are compute-bound, which means that they're very compute-intensive. So things like a video game, those are compute-bound, and we're really seeing a lot of impressive performance in video games. But then things like word processing or spreadsheets, yeah, things that are kind of the bread and butter of the office, things that we use in our home office, you're right, they really are, you know, you think, hey, my performance, my speed, the response time, it really hasn't changed very much despite all the impressive hardware improvements.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. So, do you think the hardware guys will ever get ahead of the software guys?
I don't know. I do see changes happening. What I'm sensing is that Moore's Law, that is, you know, let's double the clock rate every couple of years, that is sort of being shifted to trying to give less power consumption. You know, more longer battery life, less heat dissipation, that kind of thing. So Moore's Law can be shifted, and it's been totally applied to speed. Speed was all anybody cared about.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that we have long since passed the point when word processing users, spreadsheet users, anyone but gamers, at least in the home environment, are saying, you know, come on, this thing is just so darn slow. I mean, I press recalculate on this spreadsheet. I'm just waiting here for 2 minutes. Come on, what's the story here? And I think you'll see a little bit more of that in the future.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Let me ask you a question that may not admit to an easy answer. How do you decide when it makes sense to do some kind of an upgrade?
Yeah, that's a tough question, and what makes it more difficult is if you look at the arguments that that Microsoft or the computer companies will make, is they'll say, okay, I know your computer's only 2 years old, but if you upgrade to the latest computer, that's a capital expense, you will save in some of these other expenses. And you remember that I talked about the $500 per year versus $5,000,
mm-hmm.
and what they try to address is the total cost of ownership, which is these other things. They'll say it crashes less, it's easier to upgrade, we can fix things remotely, that sort of thing. So unfortunately, it becomes a pretty tricky situation. One thing that I'm trying to preach here is just caution, and let's go into this stuff with our eyes open. Let's, as users, insist that new technology prove it's worth first before we jump in and say, well, you're the expert, I'll just go ahead and buy it.
Let's talk with someone else, and this someone is here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Yes, I have 2 sons, one who is in the gaming industry doing quality assurance testing, and another is a son who plays a lot of games online and games from the computer. And my 21-year-old son rebuilds his computer at least annually so that it's bleeding edge. And my understanding in the marketplace is that gaming is so lucrative that's where a lot of focus is put in for all the bells and whistles compared to any other software or hardware kind of development. And I just thought, you know, I'd ask you about that trend because I think it's really interesting.
I think you're right. I think that gaming, at least in the home environment, is really where the where computing horsepower and video performance, that sort of thing, can really show its worth. Now, to some extent, being sort of taking more of a practical look at this, you can say, well, is that it? I mean, we're spending all this money as a nation on PCs, and you know, where's the beef? I mean, is it just gaming? Because it seems to me that the more mundane applications, surfing the internet, doing email, doing these word processing kind of applications, they have long since been kind of taken care of. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we're going to see improvements in that, but certainly not at the breakneck pace that we do see in gaming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks for the call. And others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, if you take the look at the amount of money that, say, business spends on IT and the amount of money they spend on upgrading, is it the case that money is really – is there a lot of money there that you actually think is wasted?
That's a tough question, and the real challenge is that whatever industry I would be talking to someone in, they are the experts, not me. So it's difficult for me to say, you know, you made a mistake by buying X instead of Y. But I think that there's a fair amount of hype that encourages companies to buy the latest just to stay on the leading edge. One way to see it that I think is relevant, if you imagine a small town that has two restaurants, and one of the restaurant owners has the bright idea he's going to advertise. So he advertises, and he takes market share away from the other guy. So now, of course, the other guy has to advertise to restore the balance to where it was before. So now they're back to the same market share balance, and yet they both have these large advertising bills. So the middleman, the advertiser, is making money, and the two restaurant owners are scratching their heads saying, okay, what's the story here? I can't not spend this extra expense because I'll lose in the marketplace. And I think to a large extent that's the problem that we have with computers, where computerization used to be a competitive advantage. You know, 20 years ago, when it was a new thing, if you were computerized, you had, and 10 years ago, if you were on the internet, that might be a new thing in your industry. But now that everybody does it, it's no longer a competitive advantage, and it's just a cost of entry. You know, I couldn't start an entrepreneurial business and say, should I not have a web page? You know, of course I'm going to have to, no matter what business I have. And there really isn't an easy way to get out of this, except I'd love for us just to take a step back, take a breath, and just pause before we jump into whatever the latest technology is. See if this technology is ready for prime time. So caution is what I'm suggesting. Mm.
Our guest, Bob Seidensticker, spent 25 years in the technology industry. He worked at IBM, worked for 8 years at Microsoft. He is the author of the book Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. It's available in paperback, published by Barrett Kohler out of San Francisco. You certainly should be able to find it in the bookstore if you want to read it. And if you'd like to be a part of the conversation here, you could do that too very easily by calling us, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Maybe we could talk a little bit about unintended consequences. One may be that, as we have discussed, that something that is sold as being a labor-saving device or something that will increase productivity ends up becoming a labor consuming device or sometimes a time-wasting device. All of those things probably aren't true. Further than that, though, do you think that there are unintended consequences or consequences of the extent to which we have embraced this kind of technology that we don't think about as much as we should?
That's an ongoing issue, and I think we need to be aware of the surprises that we've come across in the current technology, PCs and internet. But perhaps the real lesson is let's use that, let's be a bit more skeptical when the next thing comes down the road. So if it's nanotechnology or biotech or fuel cells or hydrogen in a hydrogen economy, that sort of thing, let's get excited about the new technology, but with caution. And that's going to be an ongoing thing. In fact, one person said that the intended consequences may or may not happen, but the unintended ones always do.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be the case that that's that we kind of have a tendency to embrace new technologies without asking a lot of questions, that the people who produce them, they give them to us and said, look at this wonderful new thing we've got for you. Look at all the great things that you can do with this. Sometimes seemingly without, it seems as if they haven't asked anybody, would you like to be able to do this? They introduce products with all sorts of applications, and then they sit there and say, if anybody actually seems to be interested. To me, it would make more sense to find out if people were interested before you introduced it. But it does seem to be the case that we don't talk about technology before it's implemented. We all always seems to talk about it afterwards, when problems develop, rather than before having this conversation about looking at this thing and saying, well, should we have that thing? Does it make sense to produce that thing? Is it possible that this thing might cause some problems? It just seems that that's not something that we do.
Good point. That's right. And one of the challenges that we as users have is when an expert says, hey, I'm the expert in this new thing. You're not. I'm telling you, you need to have this new technology, or this new technology is inevitable. It's going to, you know, overrun the country. And it's difficult for us to have the gumption to say, you know, I don't think so. You know, it's you can't really refute the person on technology grounds in that domain. However, what we can do is we can look at the landscape of failed predictions. There's just loads of them that I think we're all familiar with, and use that to remind us that the predictions of the next big thing, of how things are going to change, is really very problematic. In fact, you know, going down that path, we were told that if we have the telephone, then of course the video phone was inevitable. If we can predict the weather, then of course we'll soon be able to control it, and so on. We were told that home robots and e-books were inevitable, moon bases, self-driving cars, 3D movies, you know, on and on. These are things that we're all familiar with. They're almost cliche. In software, we call that vaporware. This is a product which is supposed to come out any year now, but hasn't really. And you also mentioned the problem of featureitis. That is, companies say, well, we've got a new product, it's on the calendar, we have a scheduled release, we got to put something in there. And of course there's no lack of cool ideas of things to go in, but you raise the valid question, do users really care? Mm-hmm. Now, of course, from the consumer side, to complicate the issue a little bit more, from the manufacturer side, you have examples like the iPod. No one really asked for the iPod. You know, we had other forms of portable players, you know, CD players, that sort of thing, and the iPod comes out, and people say, ooh, that's a good idea. It's, you know, good thing they didn't ask me, because I wouldn't have thought of that. So that's, unfortunately, where some of the most successful products come. So I think that we have this inherently chaotic environment where companies are throwing out stuff, seeing what sticks, and we as users, we might get some good surprises. Most of them are going to fail. Most products do fail, and we just need to be, again, skeptical about these new things and say, okay, hold on. When that is proven to me, when I see some good evidence this is going to work for me, then I'll buy.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign. Next, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. I used to be a very, very fast typist, and now I have a computer, and I have health problems also. Basically, it's a glorified typewriter, and I think maybe the old-fashioned way, maybe that's a reflection on me, was much, much simpler. And I really loved the old-fashioned. Maybe I'm an old horse and buggy person, but with that, I'll hang up. And thank you so much for this program, because I agree completely.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
That's great to hear. In fact, I think of the challenge of writing a book, which is what I recently finished doing, and to do the basic operations of a word processor, that is cutting and pasting, deleting, reprinting, saving, that kind of thing, I could have done this on a machine that was 25 years old. Now, of course, the things that I wouldn't have would be pretty fonts and pictures and internet access. But again, just the fundamental applications of word processing, they've been around for a good long time.
But sounds like you would agree that that basic word processor, you'd rather be doing that than using a typewriter.
I would. I think that you know, typewriter was a pretty huge step up from handwriting, and the basic PC, the IBM PC from 1981, was a big step up from that. But I think we need to remember that this is not linear progress. That our progress on the user side has not increased along with Moore's law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly, when I think about all the things, papers that I wrote in high school and college, I came into word processing kind of late. I'm thinking, man, if I had had that, it would have been much easier. The work would have looked better. I wouldn't have been any smarter. I don't know that the writing would have been any better, but that the mechanical process would have been a lot easier. And I think that the finished product would have been would have also been a little bit more user friendly for all of those people who had to read it and try to make something out of it.
You bet.
Questions again, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Is there, you know, when you look at maybe not so much what we have now, but you look at the kind of things that people talk about, and I guess I'm going back to your thought about how when you look at, say, go back to the 19th century, even go back to the 18th century, and look at what people said the future was going to be like, and particularly what they said technology was going to be like. It seems a little silly now, but there always is this kind of excitement, this anticipation about new stuff. If you look at what seems to be now cutting edge, or even you look at people who are in a position where they can just engage their imagination and just and do just let it go wherever it will go. I mean, is there anything in the way of future technology that, even if it doesn't exist, if it's now just a dream, maybe you don't even think it's possible, and yet you say now that is cool. If you could do that, I would have that thing.
That, I think, underscores much of the challenge that we have in fending off some of these new predictions, because they are so attractive. The predictor can say, well, wouldn't you like this to be the case? And of course, in many cases, I say, yeah, that sounds very cool, you know, flying vehicles, that sort of thing. So that is part of the challenge. We want to believe this stuff. But when you think about predicting the PC and the Internet 40 years ago, at that time, they weren't on the radar screen at all. They were completely unpredicted. It wasn't that they were underestimated. They weren't estimated at all. And that sort of underscores the inherent challenge we have. In terms of things that are coming down the road that are exciting, Ray Kurzweil is sort of a modern futurist. I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of him. He's sort of a modern-day Alvin Toffler. Alvin Toffler wrote Future Shock in 1970. And Kurzweil and other folks like him are writing about something that they call the singularity. This is the idea that the change will happen so fast that beyond that point, it's like, you know, we just can't really see or predict beyond that point. It's just going to be so crazy. And, I mean, the fundamentals I have a hard time with, because he's seeing exponential change across the entire technology landscape, which is just not the case. But he talks about some pretty weird stuff, transhumanists kind of things, where we can take our mind and put that computing, you know, all our thoughts, ideas, whatever, into a computer at some point in the near future. He's talking about the Turing test. This is the observation or the concept of a computer, which is like HAL in 2001. Someone you could talk to, and it acts just like a human. Mm. That kind of computer being here in 25 years, which again I think is you know, way overpredicted. Things like that. So some of these things are kind of exciting. So there's loads of them out there, and I'm cheering on the sidelines, but you know the history just does not point that way.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the fact that so often technological breakthroughs are not predicted, and you talked about the fact that the internet, for example, no one predicted the internet. Even people who were deeply embedded in the computer industry, people like Bill Gates, didn't really see it coming, and had to, when it was obvious that it was a force, had to run real hard to get caught up. Why, for example, when you think about the internet, I mean, why did no one envision the internet?
That's a great question. And in fact, the internet was started in 1969. So to some extent, you could say that even the people in the internet weren't, didn't anticipate the internet, at least didn't anticipate how the internet would transform society. The initial way it was used was a way to share computing power, and they want to have a communications pathway so that a researcher at MIT could use a computer in Stanford and so on. This was for government projects was the main motivation. And yet, of course, now it's just the other way around. We have gobs of computing power. Sharing computer power is rarely an issue. What we want to do is use those lines for communication. And that switch that happened in the early 1990s, and it really kind of took us by storm. It's surprising, and you know, again, we look at history and we find lots of sea changes like that, where before the telegraph, after the telegraph, that was a big deal. People just did not understand the idea of information traveling basically infinitely fast. And so lots of precedents, lots of examples like that. And in terms of trying to get away from that, get around that, to see things clearly, that's an inherently challenging problem. I wish I had had more ideas on that.
All right, let's talk with another caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Your comment that fellow's prediction is going to come true a little bit sooner than he thought. When I was a graduate student at the University of Connecticut, I took a seminar with a fellow named Al Liberman, and Al's discovery led to computer speech. And he said he went to a conference, and this was back in the early 60s, and he said the people at the conference claimed that they'd have computer speech by 2000. And he said that since those things are overestimated, he predicted 1990. Well, it turns out they had computer speech 20 years earlier than that. So it may very well be those things are going to come a lot more quickly than you think they are.
They could, and let me just give an example of how things can be kind of predicted wrong. There was an example of one amazing landmark in that area is work by Terry Winograd. This was in 1970.
Yeah.
It was his PhD thesis, and
right.
He had a very primitive graphical environment that you could talk to with English, not verbal English, but typed English, and very complicated sentences, and really just like a human. You look at the transcript, and it's basically a conversation, and very impressive.
One other thing, when I was a graduate student, I remember we had to pay $1,000 extra to get a square root button on a Marchant calculator. And we had one computer for all of New England. That was at MIT. It was a vacuum tube machine. And it went so slow, you could see the lights blinking on the console.
Times have changed.
And really, really, from my perspective, watching the field grow the way it is just awesome.
It really has changed. To just finish up on the Terry Winograd example, the speech, in my mind, really has not come to pass. I mean, in 1970 was this example. You would imagine in 1970 that that HAL of 2001 might actually happen. That would be 30 years in the future. So shouldn't have been all that challenging. And yet, even now, the most impressive artificial intelligence that I think that we normally see in our desktop is, for example, the grammar checker in Word or things like that, you know, very primitive stuff. And the idea of HAL is about as far away as it ever has been. Now, on the other hand, if you look at that example, that graphical environment, graphics has really exploded. I mean, the challenge we have now with gaming, which is just a simple PC doing these really lifelike graphic applications, the challenge that gamers have now is that the graphics is so lifelike, it's getting into the zone where instead of it being obviously a cartoon, a very impressive cartoon, it's so close to being a real human that it looks weird. And it's a sort of a paradox where as you get closer, all of a sudden the rules you apply are no longer the rules you'd apply for a well-done cartoon. But now you say you have to have rules you apply for a real, honest-to-goodness human. And it's not quite there, and that's why it looks a little bit odd. So, but that's actually an indication of how amazingly far it's gone. So the lesson that I draw from this is that looking at, in this case, text, a human speech, and graphics, and trying to figure out which one's going to win, it's a tough challenge. And in my experience, speech has really been a bit of a disappointment. We have lots of cool laboratory experiments and demonstrations, but in terms of things actually that we can use, not quite there yet.
Well, thanks a lot. It's a good program.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, again, though, just what we're saying here is that, yes, you do have to. It is remarkable if you look at the computers that we had in the 50s and you look at the what they were and what they could do and what their power requirements were and how much space they took up. And if you compare that with the kind of machine now that you can have on your desktop,
Absolutely.
That's an amazing change from that to this. However,
it
sounds like you're saying, but don't you should be careful about expecting, you know, going 50 years from today and seeing an equivalent amount of change.
That's one challenge we have to worry about, to imagine that the speedup is still going to keep happening. But the other question is the so what question. We have all this impressive performance, and you know, of course, there are lots of answers to the so what. I mean, again, with the computers we have, we can make the credit card purchase in France and have that happen almost instantaneously, and we have, you know, computers on our desk. They're cheap, lots of cool stuff. But let's not envision that the benefits that we see will go along with Moore's Law's exponential growth, because it just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, and I suppose too, sometimes it seems like the parts of this that continue to bedevil us. We have these wonderful portable computers now, but one of the things that it seems that we're really consumed with trying to do is invent a better battery, which is really not a very new technology.
Good point.
And yet, we're still, what we want to do is we'd like to have limitless power without having to plug it in someplace.
There again is the challenge that we have of imagining that the technology is all increasing exponentially. We have this Moore's Law growth with computers, and yet now that batteries are a limiting factor, hey, you can't schedule a breakthrough. You can't just say, you know, I'd like this to go at this speed. You know, it happens when it happens. It just doesn't, you know, work that way. The first battery was invented in 1799. So you're right. Battery technology has been around for a good long time. We're looking at energy. Energy is a big issue for the country, and wouldn't it be great if we could have electric cars or hybrid vehicles would be cheaper, that sort of thing. And the lead-acid battery was invented in the 1860s. The basic technology is really very staid, very mature. If only the energy industry was increasing exponentially, perhaps some of the challenges we have in society today would just go away. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way.
Well, when you think about, things, predictions that were made about devices that we would have, things that we would be doing that turned out not to be the case, and if you ask the question, well, why didn't that turn out, how much of it would be, say, A, that we can't figure out how to build something that would do that, B, we decided maybe we don't really need that, C, we don't really understand how to power it, or the energy requirements of all of these things would be more energy than we've got, or, you know, all of the above, or something else.
I think it actually is all of the above. You touched on some really important points. You could look at things like this Terry Winograd experiment of the natural speech, and we would love. There are applications where that would be great, and it just hasn't happened. It's a lot tougher problem than we thought. So in that case, we just have the technology, almost surprisingly, because technology has done so many impressive things, the technology is lagging behind the need. And you have other examples. You remember, I'm sure, the Segway, that two-wheeled vehicle that was supposed to revolutionize personal transportation from, you know, 5 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it didn't. It was an amazing technology, very cool. And yet it did not revolutionize anything. So it's been applied in very small niche applications. There, it's the other problem. It's the problem of consumer acceptance. So, okay, I'm going to buy this thing. It's fairly expensive. Where am I going to ride it? I can't ride it on the sidewalk and so on. So we have a mix of these problems. We can look at things like the Empire State Building, and when that was built, people were predicting mile-high buildings. And yet they said, well, you know, when you design this, the elevator core really has to expand a lot, and so much of the structure is consumed by that, and so on and so on, and where are people going to park? And it just didn't work out. So again, we find all these examples of technologies which have sort of reached a plateau. They've had their growth period, their explosive growth period, just like the PC and the Internet are having right now. And to a large extent, I look at all these whys, you know, why did they peak, and say those really don't matter. The main thing to take away is they do reach a plateau.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus, Bob Seidensticker. He spent 25 years in the technology industry, including a period worked at IBM and 8 years at Microsoft. He's the author of the book Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. We have time for some other calls, and we have some, in fact, ready to go here on a cell phone on our line one, so we'll talk with them. Hello.
Hi. It's really hard for me to listen to this conversation without laughing, because I just called up my mother last night on my cell phone to try to locate her in the nursing home where she's recovering from the hip implant they did on her. And then this morning I spoke to my nephew who has an implanted glucose sugar monitor hooked into her insulin pump. And I'm just driving home now in my car, which just got repaired after it got rear-ended. And luckily my airbag imploded because the computer said it had to implode so I wouldn't go through the windshield. And I'm coming from a pacemaker clinic where they were checking out my defibrillator and resynchronization pacemaker. And my Mac Mini died this morning. Just completely dead. And you're going to talk about things like iPod. I mean, let's not talk about non-serious products. There's an awful lot of non-serious products out there. And as in space research, we don't know what's going to be good. And we have to fund everything and basically see what we need. I think I will make one other very brief comment, which is when a grad approach to AI turned out to be a dead end, as almost all of the AI work did, and they need new approaches to that. And lastly, just to say, it's really not fair to put Kurzweil in the same category as Toffler, because Toffler talks and writes, and Kurzweil is one of the great technology inventors for people who read Braille. I have Braille readers, and his work in the music industry with his electronic instruments. There are people out there. There's a lot of stuff to be done. There will be a lot of things that we don't need, but we can't decide before we start to work on it what's going to turn out to be useful or not, and I don't think we should be so dismissive. Anyway, thank you.
All right. Well, there's a lot there you can respond to.
Well, that's a lot of stuff. And in short, I agree with just about everything the caller said. He raised some excellent points. And the only point that I would raise is, you know, this, he mentions that the cell phone, medical advances, car airbags, all terrific technologies. But it seems to me that the cell phone is an advance, and yet the telephone itself was perhaps a bigger advance. We have implants and other medical advances, and vaccines, antibiotics were important things in the past. In fact, even clean water and sewer systems were perhaps the biggest medical advance of all. You know, very low tech kind of stuff. And in the area of transportation, we have again a very mature industry where the real innovation, the real change was, you know, 50 some years ago with cars, trucks, airplanes, that sort of thing. So I agree with all this, and today's technology is amazing. It's doing a lot of great things for us, but let's remember the foundation on which all this is built.
Yeah. Well, again, I guess I want to make sure that people understand that you're not an anti-technology person.
Not at all, and I'm not a Luddite. I'm not suggesting we you know, wouldn't it be nice if we all farmed and just, you know, gave away everything. I love technology. I've been an engineer for 25 years. I love this stuff. What I like to see is technology applied correctly. And too often, I think we can all appreciate that it's an inherently challenging process. Companies create stuff, they throw it on the wall and see if it sticks. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It's kind of an expensive, inefficient process. So what I'm trying to do is just give some suggestions for people to navigate this process. And you know, the primary one again is be skeptical. Mm-hmm. Let's not just jump into it without thinking. Let's pause. Think, let's insist that new technology prove its worth first.
Do you think that I know that there are some people who do this kind of, who do predicting about the future, who say that this age that we're in now, whatever you want to call it, the information age or whatever, that we're coming to the end, and that we're going to the next. There will be some other one. I don't know what it is that you want to call it, but that we're coming to another point where there's going to be a significant period of change. Do you think that is the case?
I wouldn't be surprised. The book is really full of the history of technology and the lessons we can draw from that. And that is certainly what we see. We have the information age now, and we were told that that was, you know, amazing. And yet in the 60s, we had the space age. We were told that that was amazing, was going to change everything. We were told in the 50s that nuclear power would change everything. We were in the nuclear age, and we had the jet age, and, you know, so on and so on. So we're seeing some amazing stuff, and yet, again, let's remember the precedents we see from history. And I would imagine that the information age might be winding down. Maybe it'll sort of taper down as other things pick up. Trying to predict which one that is, I mean, is it going to be fusion power? Is it going to be biotech, nanotech? Lots of cool stuff. One problem we have is imagining this stuff is inevitable. That is, you know, you read the look at the cover of Popular Science and you see some new breakthrough. Well, that's great. Most breakthroughs never make it out of the lab. Most products that do make it out of the lab fail. So it's a very long, painful road. Ask any entrepreneur how challenging it is to go from the light bulb over your head to the product which is used by half the country. That is a long, very failure-prone road. Very challenging.
Our guest, Bob Seidensticker. He spent 25 years in the technology industry, worked at IBM, 8 years at Microsoft. He's the author of the book Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. It's available now in paperback, published by Barrett Kohler Publishers out of San Francisco. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Mr. Seidensticker, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.